I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Who's really responsible for keeping our food supply safe? Food safety and the FDA today on the show. Plus, Jonathan Gold stops by to tell us about one of the best meals he's ever had. And it's that time of year when we're asking you, our listeners, to support KCRW and Good Food. If you do, there's a free meal in your future. But first, let's find out what's fresh at the farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We have a local treasure here in Santa Monica. She is a resident, she's a chef, she's a James Beard Award-winning cookbook writer, Neelam Batra, who is a regular here at the Wednesday Market when she's not traveling back to India to get more inspiration for recipes. And Neelam, you're shopping today, you have your cart, and you got your granddaughter with you. Tell us what you're going to be buying and cooking from the market, would you?
There's 100 treasures over here, but the thing that I'm really looking forward to cooking today is a chicken dish with peaches in it. Lots of fresh peaches, which I'm going to just puree in a food processor and use them to cook the chicken, along with some spices that I'm going to add, and use peaches like you would tomatoes in a curry or in a sauce and whatever, and they are just outstanding.
Now, how do you puree the peaches? Do you skin them? Do you blanch them? Do you cut them up? How do you do that?
I leave everything right in there and heat some olive oil in a pan. Then once it's a little hot, let's add some cumin seed, whole cumin seed. When it sizzles, add the ginger and some chopped garlic. Then add the onion. I add some chili peppers and some coriander powder, and some cumin. Add the chicken, and then I'll add the peaches. And in the end, just to give it a little tartness, I'll add a little bit of fresh lime juice.
That sounds so delicious. All in one skillet.
All in one skillet.
1 hour max, start to finish. And we can start using some of these peaches because there are so many peaches, we don't even know what to do with them.
You know what you can also use in the same recipe is plums and pluots and all types of soft fruits. They're just wonderful.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Laura.
That was Neelam Batra, and she's out here cooking with inspiration from the market and helping us figure out what to do with all these delicious peaches and plums and nectarines. We're looking around the market here for all kinds of summer things, and it's so interesting when these seasons start to overlap, and we're actually seeing what I would call winter squash, which is the acorn squash and the butternut squash, and Barbara here with Tutti Frutti Farm, which is a certified organic farm, has these beautiful delicata and sweet dumpling squash, and they are like a kaleidoscope of color. It's green and orange and yellow and striped and ribbed, and one looks like a little baby pumpkin and one looks like a giant cucumber. So, Barbara, you like these. I mean, obviously, Chris grows them because they're popular. Tell us how they taste and how you cook them.
Well, first of all, you can see they're a smaller squash than the other winter squash, and it's got a thinner skin. So you can cook it whole. You don't have to get the big, heavy knife. And I mean, they're even single serving, so you don't have to wrap one up in the refrigerator. And the thing is with what people call winter squash, it is the same season as summer squash. It all grows in the summer. It needs the heat to grow, like tomatoes, peppers. And the reason they're called the winter squash is they have the hard shell on them to where they can store. Like, you know, in the old days when people had their cellars and they had to store stuff that they grew for to get through the winter, these squashes were very popular because they could store them, even though they were growing out throughout the summer. And as I said with these, you can cook it whole. People, the skin is thin enough. People even eat the skin on them.
And are there many seeds inside?
They have the seeds in the center, like all squashes. You just scrape out the seeds out of the center, and then you have the flesh around the rest of it. And it's an orange, sweet flesh, like a butternut. I think the closest I could say is butternut, probably a little sweeter than a butternut, but the same sweet, creamy flesh.
And I wonder, you could probably even pan fry them if you put them cut side down and just simmered them real slow, because I know you can do that with a butternut, so that might be a nice thing to have on the side.
Yeah, and I think if you just add a little water to make sure they don't dry out, give them a little moisture, it would do well. Cut them in half, take out the seeds and do that, as I said, because they're small enough and thin enough.
Right. And so these are growing now, and it must be getting awfully hot up there. So eventually these plants die back. You're going to harvest them and then store them and then keep bringing them?
Yeah.
So if we wanted to buy a winter stash for ourselves, we could take these home, put them on a shelf, cool, dry.
Yeah, cool and dry and dark. Yeah, you don't want them on a shelf where they're going to get sun. Best a cabinet, a drawer that is cool and dry. Because any moisture or any heat is going to start either molding them or wilting them.
Okay. Yeah, they're just beautiful. And they're nice and heavy, so you know they're full of juice right now.
Yeah.
That was Barbara Wyman, and she is a longtime employee over here with Tutti Frutti Farm. And interesting to see these really pretty, brightly colored squash that you can cook even now in the summer, or you can save them for winter. Not only is it the time of year for really fantastic fruits and vegetables here at the market, it is the time of year, these times come so fast, where we are asking listeners who enjoy the show, who like hearing from the farmers, to please send in a pledge of support for KCRW. Keep this programming on the air. It's all about choice, folks. And if you don't support the things you love, the choice may not be there someday. I'm a regular subscriber. I could not live without KCRW, and I hope you feel the same, and I hope you'll pick up the phone right now. Call in, support the farmers, support the show, and keep this wonderful information on the air. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Get the recipe you just heard and see pictures of the produce at kcrw.com/goodfood. Laura Avery posts a weekly blog post from the Farmers Market on the Good Food blog. Read it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Food contamination has unhappily become a fact of life. One day it's peanut butter, the next cookie dough. What can and should the Food and Drug Administration do about it? David Kessler was the commissioner of the FDA for 7 years under Bill Clinton. During his tenure, he famously fought for better food labeling, especially regarding products that use the word, quote, fresh, unquote. He also fought and succeeded in regulating tobacco. Welcome, Dr. Kessler.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a while since you've been at the FDA. It's been over 10 years. What do you think about where we are now with regards to food safety, and what would you like to see being done in this administration?
FDA is the most important consumer protection agency in the world, and I care a lot about it. And I applaud the president's appointment of Peggy Hamburg as commissioner and Josh Sharfstein as principal deputy commissioner. They're very dedicated public servants, as are the other people who work at FDA. I am concerned about our food safety system. We've had a whole series of outbreaks of late, peanut butter, some of our produce that have been in the headlines. The problem is we don't have a system that prevents problems from happening. So we're constantly chasing the horse after it's out of the barn. We need to put in place a system of preventive controls. Right now, FDA, if there's a problem, and the problem happens, and people are being harmed, FDA has to go in and figure out where that problem is. But the problem has to happen first. And that's no system at all, in my view. It's a reactive system. It's not a proactive system.
So do you think that food safety is the single most important thing facing the current administration with regard to food?
I think food safety is the number one on the agenda for FDA. We have to keep it in perspective, right? Because if you look at the number of people who have serious illnesses from food, even infectious disease, I mean, understand that still pales in comparison with something like obesity. So while there may be, 5,000 to 10,000 deaths, far too many, don't get me wrong, from food safety, you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of deaths from obesity. So we have to keep some relative perspective.
So let's talk about obesity. You've just written this this marvelous book, The End of Overeating, and you talk a lot about what food manufacturers do to promote highly processed, fatty, calorie-rich, and salt-rich foods. Do you think that the FDA or local principalities should be involved in regulating the choices that Americans eat? I'm thinking about the trans fat bans that some cities have enacted.
What's driving the obesity epidemic? What's driving us to gain more and more weight? Back 10 years ago, there were 4 cases of diabetes per 1,000 people, type 2 diabetes. Today, that number is 9, double what it was just 10 years ago. We spent, in the year 2000, $7 billion on drugs for diabetes. Today, we're spending $13 billion on drugs for diabetes. What is it? Is it the trans fats? Is it that simple? No. What we have done is taken sugar, fat, and salt, put them in highly stimulating combinations, layered it and loaded it into our food, put it on every corner, made it socially acceptable, added the advertising, made food into entertainment. It's as if we are all engaged in this great food carnival.
So do you think that there should be tobacco-like regulation of the food industry?
What was the real success with regard to tobacco? Right. Was it regulation? I believe in it, and I fought for it. And finally, we're going to get it. Right. But what was the real success? We changed the way we view the product. We used to view tobacco as something that was glamorous, that was sexy, as something that was cool, something I wanted to do. And we changed how Americans perceive that product. Today, we look at tobacco and we say, that's a deadly addictive product. And when a product is reinforcing, the best thing you can do is to change what scientists call the valence of the product. We used to have tobacco used to be positively valence. Now it's negatively valence. Food is much harder. We can't view food negatively. But at a certain point, this big food, this food that is served endlessly, that's just layered with fat on fat on sugar and fat. I mean, pick any dish that's served, you know, in most places, even some of our good places, some of the better restaurants, and look at it. It's just layers of fat on fat on sugar on fat. There needs to be disclosure. We need to change how we as consumers, we as people, look at food.
So you think that if companies are forced or encouraged to be more transparent, that it will affect the way we view what we're consuming?
Absolutely. Disclosure is very high on the list. I think government has a role to educate, to require disclosure. The food industry has responsibility to understand that they just can't put sugar, fat, and salt on every corner and advertise it endlessly. But most importantly, we as consumers, because we're being constantly stimulated, because our brains are being activated by this hyperpalatable foods, as I point out in the book, it's our responsibility to take control, to fight back, to prevent ourselves from being manipulated. It begins with us.
Just last week, the House passed a bill introduced by Representative Henry Waxman of California, granting the Food and Drug Administration the authority it needs to better oversee the safety of the nation's food supply. Find out more about the bill and about Dr. Kessler's book, The End of Overeating, on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I also asked Dr. Kessler about the dumpster diving he did while researching his book. Hear what he had to say. It's posted on the Good Food blog. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Podcast listeners may not be aware that KCRW, which produces this program, is a public radio station. You know what that means? It means we rely on the support of our listeners to produce the kind of high-quality shows you expect. So just at a time when you're thinking about where to save money, take a second to think about what good food means to you. We're asking podcast listeners to support Good Food and KCRW by donating just $5 a month. That really small amount will make a huge difference, and it helps us bring you the kind of quality programming you expect from KCRW. Go to kcrw.com/join to become a subscriber. You could win a trip to Paris or a Mini Cooper convertible. One of our go-to wine experts is Stacy Hunt. In honor of our pledge drive, she's put together two incredible flights of wine from hard-to-find producers. Learn about these wines next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW, and I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. Good Food's original wine guru is Stacy Hunt. Stacy comes to us from Duvan Wine and Spirits, and she's here with us today to talk about some pretty fabulous things that she's donating as a premium.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You're so generous. Tell us what it is.
Well, we have two premium packages, and I call them Stacy Selects for a Good Food Wine Flight. And we've packaged two very distinct premiums. One is a two-bottle selection where we have two bottles under the price of, $17. But that does not mean that these are not fantastic bottles. In fact, one is a gold medal winner. And then the second one is a four-bottle package. And this is more of the Saturday night, or let's say Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, a bottle a night package. And this has an international selection of wines coming from Baja California, from Italy, from Paso Robles, California, one of my favorite regions in California, and then also from another part of Italy that people don't know too much about, and that's down in the south in the area.
Basilicata.
Yeah, and Calabria, where there's...
The Vulture.
So all of these wines are wines that are not readily available in a grocery store. They're quite special, and the four-bottle package has a price range of $20 up to about $36, $37 per bottle. So these are some really terrific wines.
So let's talk about the two-bottle package first.
Okay. The two-bottle package has... I'm going to start with the gold medal winner. This is a white wine. It comes from the Loire Valley in France, and it's called Ruy. And I'll spell it for you. It's R-E-U-I-L-L-Y. So it looks like Ruy, but it's really Ruy. I hope I'm doing that right.
Ruy.
And this bottle of wine is 100% Sauvignon Blanc. It is crisp. It is minerally. It just pairs beautifully with any type of shellfish or seafood. And the second bottle that's in there is, and now for something completely different.
Totally different.
You fly all the way to the southern part of Italy to Basilicata. And this is a wine called Ciro. And that's spelled C-I-R-O. And this is a very interesting grape. The grape is called Galliopo. It originally came from Greece. That's where its birthright is. And then during the time of the early Olympians, there was a lot of cross travel between Greece and Italy and all these areas. And as athletes and warriors went back and forth, they took their favorite bottles and grape cuttings with them. So Galliopo established itself as a national grape in the area of Basilicata. And I always say that the Olympians, which is true, used to drink several bottles of Galliopo during their training. And just imagine what a bottle of this will do for your workout.
Okay, so now let's go to the sort of the gold package. If this first one was silver, then we can think of the second as gold, which is the four-bottle package.
Now here, we've journeyed over to Austria, and we've picked up a bottle of Riesling. This Riesling comes from an area in Austria called Palt. And Palt is in the lower part of Austria near the Bohemian section. And normally you would think of that section as being a beer section. But kind of like you think of Baja as being a cerveza place, but the wines are really extraordinary. The same thing is going on in this part of Austria. It's known for beer, but it's making amazing wine. Austrian Rieslings are very different from German Rieslings because they are not really sweet. The difference in winemaking law in Austria is you don't add sugar, you know, to the degree that you add sugar in Germany. So here you have, again, a Riesling that is highly aromatic because Riesling is classified as an aromatic grape. And when you drink this wine, it will be bone dry, terrific acid, but filled with fruit in your mouth.
And then for the next bottle that makes up the four-bottle package,
well,
it's the Calabrian wine.
Yes, the Calabrian wine. And I know you're a fan of Calabria. This area, again, is southern Italy. And the Del Volturi region is famous for a grape called Alianico. Robust, full-bodied, packed with fruit, black plums, blackberries, just an extraordinary wine. Not all that well-known right now, but we have it.
Okay, now I think we're coming home to California.
We're coming home to the Central Coast. And for me, I am crazy about what goes on in Paso Robles. This is the Rhone varietal area of California. This one, Triana, is pretty famous. It's known as the white wine for red wine drinkers. So any red wine drinker out there that says, foof, I don't care about white wine. It's too, you know, too light, too this, too that. I can tell you that the Triana will change your mind. It's a blend of Viognier, Marsan, and Roussan. And it has what I would call a scent of oak rather than a taste of oak in it. And so it's packed with fruit, very lush and very classy.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. And then, of course, I know to one of your favorite places, Baja.
Right. Baja California is an area that has been producing wine for about 200 and some odd years, but has only in the last decade begun to become recognized with international awards and just awareness and editorial critiques. And this particular wine is a Tempranillo. Tempranillo does beautifully in this area, as it does in Spain. And this one is done in the old style manner. This is not what I would call a New World wine. This is done in the way it would be done in Rioja. So you don't have a high amount of fruit. You have enough fruit. You don't have a high amount of alcohol. It's about 13.5% alcohol.
And who's the producer of this Tempranillo?
It is Cavas Valmar, one of the oldest producers, family producers, family owned in the Baja region.
Stacy Hunt is a sommelier and comes to us from Splash Productions and Duvan Wine and Spirits in West Hollywood. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to see a list of the wines that Stacy talked about. Coming up next on Good Food, LA-based food writer Jonathan Gold is here to tell us about one of the best meals he's had in quite a while. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. It's that time of the Saturday morning where we get Jonathan Gold to guide us to a marvelous new place that we haven't tried to eat. Jonathan is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Los Angeles Weekly, writing so many counterintelligence columns that famously whet our appetites. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
Where are we going today?
We are going to, I suppose, West Hollywood adjacent.
Oh, that's nice. And what are we going to find there?
We are going to find an odd but completely delicious modern French restaurant that is stuffed into a bakery.
We must be talking about Ludo Bites at Bread Bar.
We are, in fact. I sort of love the idea that Bread Bar is doing it all their things, of having chefs come in to cook for a few months, almost like DJs doing guest sets at clubs. You get to go and you get to taste somebody's food. They build up a clientele. Then before you have the chance to get bored, they move on. Ludovic Lefebvre, who has done Ludo Bites before a couple of years ago and was famously the chef at Bastide who introduced molecular gastronomy to Los Angeles, is cooking. And it's basically just him, maybe one, two other guys in the kitchen. It's this incredibly personal food at prices that aren't so high.
Yeah, it's. I find it really interesting because usually when you have a chef like Ludo in the kitchen, his hands are not touching everything. But this is a very different experience.
Right. And when he goes back to a place with, as I assume he will, like Bastide or L'Orangerie, then in fact he will be the guy just barking orders at the pass. And he won't actually be the guy pureeing your soup. But it's nice that he is because, you know, he's a master. He's a wonderful chef.
Now, the last time he did this, it was just wildly successful. And it seems just from glancing at the menu that it's expanded big time.
It has. Last time he did it, it was more little tapas, little bites sort of things. Like he did something called broccamole, which was like a spicy guacamole made from broccoli. It was like good idea, definitely not something that you would have gone to Bastide for. And in the current incarnation of the restaurant, or at least the current menu, it seems the dishes are really ambitious. I mean, really ambitious.
Okay, give us some examples.
There's a soup, for example. It's just described on the menu as chorizo, cantaloupe, cornichon.
Okay, so sausage, mm-hmm. fruit, and pickles.
Right.
Okay.
The last thing I think you would expect was a beautiful chilled cream soup of cream pureed with, I guess, sautéed chorizo, so which has really nice full flavor. There's chunks of ripe cantaloupe in it, whose sweetness is actually perfect with it, sort of a prosciutto and melon effect. And then on the inside is a sort of icy granité of pickles and onions that's very sharp flavored.
So it's like a charcuterie plate in a bowl.
Exactly. It's a charcuterie plate redefined as a soup.
That's genius.
And it's not stupid. It's really, really good. There's another one of his, I guess you can't call them famous dishes, but the dishes that I think he's doing really well is a foie gras tart, basically like chunks of chilled foie gras on this wonderful sort of, would you call it a brick pastry? Anyway, this really flaky, buttery pastry that has been infused with maple syrup. On the side, there's a paste that I think is Meyer lemon that has been
wow,
like pureed, but it's a stiff paste. It's not a slurry. The maple and the foie gras go well. There's the crunchy and the soft. There's the smooth and the sort of jagged. And then there's this super sharp condiment on the side.
Now, are these tasting menus? Are the amounts that you're getting of each thing quite small? So you sort of put together a menu of like three or four or five things?
I think you would probably choose, you know, maybe three dishes apiece. And they're big enough to... They're big enough to pass and they're big enough to sit in the middle of the table. And I think he more or less expects that everybody's going to more or less taste everything. Though, I don't know. I mean, I haven't talked to him about it or sat in the kitchen or anything. But most of the people around us seem to be having pretty much everything. There's a like a soup, like a velouté with white asparagus that has mozzarella ice cream in the middle.
Wow, so it's like white on white?
Yeah, and there's like really, really thin wisps of fennel and black olives that I assume have been like dehydrated in an oven or something because they're super small and they're super black and they're super chewy and they have a pungency, but they don't have any of like the juiciness of olives. So it's olives acting kind of as a spice.
Very interesting.
One of the most interesting dishes, I think, is a sweetbread dish. There's like a stick of licorice root, like a giant, like splintery twig, like thrust through the heart of the sweetbread, which is then sautéed, and the flavor of the licorice just goes throughout.
That sounds marvelous.
And there's something that he calls imaginary choucroute. It's about the size of three butter pats put together, basically transparent, and it's this gelée of sauerkraut juice.
Oh, I love that. He's having fun.
He's having a lot of fun. And it's the sort of thing that if you went to a restaurant and you paid $54 for this, you might grumble at one thing or another. Though I don't think you would. It's that good. But if you're paying $16 for it, it's like, why not?
Fantastic. What about desserts?
The desserts are perhaps more conventional than the rest of it, but There's an extremely, extremely dark chocolate mousse that has been laced with chilies. So it's bitter and ow, bitter and ow, bitter and ow. And it's not laced with chilies in the Mexican way. It's very French with that sort of like little tingle of pain at the end of it. The Marquis de Sade hits the dessert board.
That's hysterical. Okay, so this is Ludobites at Bread Bar. And where is Bread Bar?
At 8718 3rd Street in Los Angeles.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic for the LA Weekly. Find the address for Ludobites at Bread Bar at kcrw.com/goodfood. Connect with me and other Good Food listeners by becoming a fan of me on Facebook. We do cookbook giveaways and we share food pics and stories. Follow me on Twitter, too. I'm at Evan Kleiman, only one N in the last name. You can download the show and podcast it, too. Find the Good Food video app and find all the information we talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. I hope you'll consider donating to KCRW. Support the programming you love by listening as a subscriber. Go to kcrw.com/join for as little as $5 a month. I'd be very, very grateful. Thanks.